All right, it is now 4 p.m. Eastern Time in the U.S., 9 p.m. GMT. So time to kick off the Football Scholars Forum for December 2013. The topic of this session is independent football writing in the digital age. And it's a great pleasure to welcome author, journalist, and editor Jonathan Wilson to the forum. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
As well as the record number of participants we have online from not just North America, but also Europe, Southern Africa, South America, and the Persian Gulf. So great international group. Again, if you are participating in this Skype call and you're not speaking, it would be very helpful if you muted your microphones. Because we are getting quite a bit of ambient sound and other conversations. We usually give the special guest a couple of minutes at the beginning to speak about the book essay that we're discussing. And I want to change our format just a little bit because, you know, the Football Scholars Forum and the Blizzard have an interesting shared origin. They were both born in a pub. The Football Scholars Forum was born at the Peanut Barrel in East Lansing in December of 2009. There was a FIFA referee in attendance who sanctioned it as an official birth act. And of course, the Blizzard was born at Fitzgerald's in Sunderland in 2010. And so I think both the Forum and the Blizzard are living proof of the wisdom of the Chui language proverb of Ghana: what alcohol is used for, water cannot be a substitute. We also have a few other things in common. I think both the Football Scholars Forum and the Blizzard kind of inhabit in-between spaces, somewhere beyond conventional mainstream journalism and academia. We have some similarities in structure and purpose, if not in form, because we're both kind of self-organized, highly collaborative groups and independent. We aim to read, write, discuss, and think about football and its relationship to the social world. And we have one foot planted in the intellectual domain and the other foot in the realm of the popular. We're also both kind of analog and digital, and I think we trace our origins to similar processes of this kind of democratization of football writing and readership in the 80s and 90s with the fanzines, but also developments in the humanities and the social sciences that I think opened up in very productive ways to the study of sport. So I was surprised then when Jonathan circulated, and thank you for circulating issue 9 of the Blizzard, I was surprised to read his editor's note. He says, football is a terribly angry sport. And he expressed quite a bit of frustration with the nastiness and the self-entitlement that was described in that note. I wonder, Jonathan, if you can attribute this nastiness, this anger, to the nature of digital media, you know, the web's comment sections, and to Twitter. Or is this nastiness the other side of the kind of democratization coin that I referred to earlier?
I think it's probably both. That what Twitter etc. gives us is a way of seeing that angriness. But I think people often would tweet something that previously, you know, they might have thought but wouldn't necessarily have said, or wouldn't have said to an audience beyond the two or three people who were with them. So, yeah, I think, you know, the social media has just sort of allowed us to see that, and it's made that interaction much more direct. That if you as a writer write something that somebody disagrees with, you know, they rather than just sort of reading it and sort of shrugging and saying something to their wife or you know, their mate or whatever, they come straight back at you and sort of have a pop at you on Twitter. And in the worst cases, there's sort of orchestrated campaigns by fans or you know, followers of a particular player or team. Which is, you know, in some cases get quite nasty. I guess the anger maybe is just a byproduct of the amount people care about football. That it's always needed an outlet, and perhaps now Twitter, social media gives voice to that, whereas previously you know, is expressed either in chanting at the stadium, moaning in the pub, in the worst cases, yeah, out and out hooliganism.
Great. Who would like to ask Jonathan the next question?
It's not a question, but
make
it's
a
just
comment.
An observation.
Yeah.
Comments, yes. I think that the anger was always there, and it's amplified. I mean, I agree with Jonathan on that. It's hugely amplified by this new means of communicating it to, you know, the whole world. But, for example, Nick Hornby writes very well about all the frustration and anger he sees at Arsenal in the late 60s and early 70s. In a sense, that draws him to the crowd. It was always a place, a sort of slightly transgressive place, and it's probably got something to do with the form of the game itself, the way that we all identify, fans identify with the story unfolding of the game, as they don't with other sports necessarily. They feel it's their entitlement. That's just my tuppence worth.
I think the entitlement is actually something slightly quite new, that slightly different to the anger, but something that seems to me a feature of certainly of English football in the last decade or so that wasn't there before.
Is this
notion that, you know, if you're a moderately good side and you're even drawing at half time, you often see the team being booed off. That when I started going to games in the 80s, that just didn't happen. And you know, it's a regular thing. You know, a team like Tottenham or Arsenal maybe before this season, where there's sort of this long-standing frustration, this sense they should be doing better than they are, but this sort of the booing of a team for not quite achieving the result you want, you almost come to expect it. Now, I find that a very, very strange thing, this sense that when you pay for your ticket to go and watch the match, you're somehow not just paying to be allowed in and to see what happens, but there's somehow a contract and the team has to produce a certain result, or you've been cheated in that transaction of buying the ticket.
Hello.
Okay, we welcome Laurent Dubois to the conversation at this point. Hi, Laurent.
Sorry about being delayed and interrupting, but carry on.
Alex Galarza has the next question, and then Chris Lash.
Hi, Jonathan. I'm bringing saludos from Marcela Mora y Araujo. I had lunch with her the other day. There's a bit of a center of gravity in this conversation with one of us. A few of us do research there. Jonathan spent a lot of time there. Others have spent time there. So I'm already missing it with this 40-degree weather in Detroit. I came from 88-degree weather. But my question is about the audience of the Blizzard. I really enjoyed the issue that we read. We had people who have participated in the forum before, contributing pieces, all excellent stuff. I particularly enjoyed the interview with the FIFA ethics lawyer, Garcia. And I wanted to congratulate you on heading up such a fantastic project. My question is about how you originally envisioned the audience of the Blizzard and how that's changed over time now that you're over 10 issues deep now. How reactive have you been to the types of pieces people enjoy? Have you solicited more pieces that have been sort of in a particularly successful genre that you've gotten good feedback on, shorter or longer, or having to do with politics, or having to do with game, you have like a best games series in the magazines as well. But I just wondered if you could tell us how that's evolved over time, and I think we'd all get a lot of maybe some useful notes out of that as we all play with the idea of making our work more accessible as academics, and perhaps the inverse as well.
I wish you'd say there was some sort of great vision at the start, but there really wasn't. There was, on my part, this great frustration. There was one particular piece that sort of tipped me over the edge. That some of you may be familiar with the story of Steve McConaughey, who was the first black South African to play professionally in Europe. His story, as a black South African coming to England in the 50s, was extraordinary in itself. And then what happened to him later in his life when he ended up being jailed for throwing acid in the face of the woman he just got divorced from and her lawyer, which he always claimed he'd never done, and that he'd been fitted up by the CIA, which may or may not be true, but it's a fascinating story. And in the build-up to the 2010 World Cup, it just seemed to me that this was a story that should be told. There was an obvious hook there, and none of my usual outlets were interested. The newspaper said, "Oh, we can only give you, 800 words or whatever," which just didn't seem to do the story justice. And magazines said, "Oh, well, it's not quite right for us. It's a bit heavy. It's a bit gloomy. It's a bit grim. It's a bit too difficult." When their whole thing about South Africa was all redemptive and all, this is a great moment for Africa and everything. They didn't want this, quite a tragic personal story. And that left me enormously frustrated, and going around press rooms moaning to people. I found a lot of other journalists had similar frustrations, that they had pieces where either they couldn't be given the length to write in the detail they wanted to, or that stories were seen as being too difficult for the audience. And so I think it was actually Gab Marcotti where the idea first really germinated, that we sort of were chatting to each other. I think it was at Stamford Bridge, and we sort of said, "Well, what we need need to take control. We need to get rid of the middlemen, the people who are constantly pandering to focus groups, the people who sort of talk to audiences. We don't care about that. We want to focus on the writing, on the piece itself, and we, the writer, should take control, and we should make it a profit share." And I suspect he thought no more of it, and to be honest, I didn't really think that much more of it. Then after the Cup of Nations in Angola, my father fell ill during that tournament. I came home immediately after the final and rushed up to Sunderland, and so I was in Sunderland for 3 months in a row, which is unusual for me. And as a result, I went to a lot more Sunderland games as a fan. And I was in the pub before Sunderland played Bolton one night, and I was banging on about this disgrace of not being able to place this piece, and how what we needed was a journalist to take control. And a lad called Peter, who I'd been at school with, he's been a mate for 20 odd years. He suddenly says, "Well, you know what I do for a living?" And I sort of turns and, "Well, yeah, you're a designer and publisher." I was like, "Oh, hang on, you're a designer and publisher. You could help this magazine happen." So we'd already had probably 3 or 4 pints by then, and we had a few more, and we watched the game, and we had a few more afterwards. And the next morning I woke up and I sort of thought, "Oh, we had that daft idea last night about that magazine." And I was like, actually, there's not that much was that daft about it. So I rang him, and he'd been having exactly the same thought, that maybe there is some mileage in this. And it then took us about a year to get everything together. That first issue, the pilot issue zero, was a case of just sort of speaking to everybody I could think of who produced the sort of content that I thought wasn't getting a run elsewhere. And that was either because of the length, because of the obscurity or perceived obscurity, because of the perceived difficulty or perceived complexity of what they were writing about. And once that had happened, and once people knew what we were doing, and once people saw the pilot, we got ideas coming in from all over the place. And I can't honestly say that there's really been much change from that. And I was sort of quite confident that there was a market for that type of writing. I wasn't sure how big it was or whether it was big enough to make the magazine economically viable. And thankfully it is, or is at the moment. And I mean, apart from odd little tweaks here and there, and sort of, I think possibly, I'm not going to sort of name the pieces, but I think a couple of the early magazines we suffered from having pieces that were too long, like longer than they needed to be. I hope we've sort of cut back on that. It's always a problem when people are suddenly given free rein and not given any limitations. They can go over the top. I think we started to get that under control. But basically, whatever people pitch, whatever people suggest, as long as it interests me, and as long as I can sort of see that it fits in our niche, which is essentially a niche made up of niches that aren't covered elsewhere, then I'll accept it. And I think really the key is to maintain that eclecticism. And I accept that, you know, a lot of readers, there'll be two or three pieces in each issue that they're not really interested in, they don't really care about, maybe don't even read. But that's part of the package. You get the whole thing together. And I think it's actually one of the interesting things about the design of the magazine, or just sort of the design of magazines in general, that I think you end up reading things you wouldn't necessarily click on a website. You know, if you had the whole internet there and all these kind of thousands of choices, and you saw a piece on, I don't know, football in Kazakhstan or something, even if you think, oh, that might be interesting, you probably wouldn't get around to reading it, or you might not get around to reading it. Whereas if you've bought this package of 20 or 25 pieces, you probably will read it because you've paid for it and it's there. And so you sort of smuggle things in under the cover of the more mainstream pieces. So eclecticism's the key. I don't really think that there is that strong an editorial policy in terms of directing things one way or the other.
Great. We have a thanks, Jonathan. We have a list of questions here, and we also have another person that just joined the conversation in California, Alon Rab, who was the special guest in the previous forum. Welcome, Alon.
Thank you.
Please, can you mute your microphone when you're not speaking?
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so the list I have right now, the next five questions, and again, it's a big group, so we are going to have to proceed as efficiently as we can. Lindsay, then Ruani, then Liz Timms here with me, and Dave Blosky and he's Lansing. Chris Lash and Tom Vinacci in that order. So Lindsay, take it away.
All right. Hi, thank you. My question has to do with sports diplomacy, and specifically, what types of intersections do you see between sports journalism and publications such as The Blizzard and sports diplomacy efforts, or helping diplomats better understand athletic cultures within given societies as kind of like as a window into society?
If I'm not absolutely certain I understand the question, but if I do, I think sort of 20, 25 years ago, there was sort of a rash of articles came out on how football could explain the world, sort of how football was this great tool for examining societies. And I think there is a truth to that. I just think you've got to be slightly careful not to be too blunt about that. You know, it can give you a view into a world, but it's only ever a partial view. And I think you've got to be... Or, you know, my policy as a football writer is always don't try and stretch your conclusions too far. Focus on the football, focus on what you know, and if other truths sort of crop up, if they emerge from that, well, so be it. But I think there can be a danger if you try and force football into explaining a culture or society. It can offer insights, but it's never going to give you the full picture. Is that what you're asking, or have I misinterpreted that?
Slightly. I guess I was more interested in the ways that there is an intersection between sports diplomacy and sports journalism. Whether it's in covering programs or in people who are planning diplomatic and sports outreaches, what are, how to get better clue into countries' sports culture, whether it's the mainstream sports journalism or whether publications that go a bit more in depth and detail, such as The Blizzard or The Howler, might be sort of a different avenue in.
From the
journalist's perspective.
I mean, if we're talking about outreach programs, I was in Zaatari, the Syrian refugee camp in northern Jordan, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? I wrote a piece for The Guardian on that this week, and I have to say, while writing it, I felt slightly fraudulent. Don't tell The Guardian this, whatever you do. Because, to be honest, I don't really have a clue about the issues that are happening there. Yeah. I saw what I saw in the 2 hours, 3 hours. I did what I could as a journalist to ask what seemed to me the relevant questions. I came out knowing far more than I got in with, but was that really enough to write a fair piece? So I deliberately sort of tried to focus the piece on two interviews with people who are doing coaching work there, to try and build self-confidence among either kids or teenagers there, and to try and sort of focus on the human as much as possible. I'm always, you know, the nature of football journalism now, if any time you go to, I mean, pretty much any country, and I know it'll happen in Brazil in the World Cup next year, it certainly happened in South Africa in 2010, is that these media trips are put on to outreach projects, you know, for various causes, various charities. And you, people always write these sort of pieces about, oh, isn't this terrible, isn't life here awful, but look at football making a difference. And I have to say, I get quite cynical about that and slightly suspicious. And I'm not really... My concern is always, I don't really understand this, I don't really know what's going on. I know football, and I know that kind of, you know, this favela or whatever doesn't look like the kind of place I'd want to live. And apart from that, I'm sort of in the dark. And so I guess those pieces wouldn't get in papers if the football angle weren't there. But I personally, I always feel slightly uncomfortable. There's just sort of it's very superficial, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Ruani.
Hey, Jonathan.
Hi.
I have a quick question. Initially it was going to be a quick question, which was back to the publishing model of Blizzard. You know, what were some of the alternate models you might have discussed in the formative stage that might have looked different than the current incarnation? But it also got me thinking about a project that that I've worked alongside of, but not directly with, in the digital humanities, and in which creating sort of a public venue for thinking out your ideas out loud before they get into their final stage, sort of a way to get immediate peer feedback where the writing piece becomes more of a sort of a living document instead of static, always evolving with that feedback. Has there been any discussion, at least among journalists, as a way of finding a model to think out loud and to use sort of social networking and the media tools we have to further your own thought process and making that very public?
Okay, I'll take the second question first. I think no, or well, not that I'm aware of, mainly for very cynical reasons, which is if we have an idea, we want to protect it and sell it. And we don't want to just let other people see it and then... Yeah, I think academics and journalists come at it from a very different point of view. There's always an economic imperative there as a journalist. You're always looking for what can I do differently, what can I sell, what can I do to make editors notice me. Whereas I guess on the academic side, there's more of a sense of, you know, what's actually right here, what's true, what's interesting, which is a shame. But it's, you know, it's just the nature of the beast that I guess because journalism is so often so sort of transitory, but you write it one day and you forget it the next. There is that sort of unwillingness to go deeper and to try and get feedback. When I write books, and I guess it's probably true of most people who write books, then I circulate the draft among, you know, as many people as I think could conceivably offer further information. So I think there's a difference there between the sort of 800 word piece and the, you know, the 100,000 word book, with I guess probably gradations in between. I would also say in relation to that that most journalists I know of are pretty ambivalent at best about comments on pieces and on it being open to interaction, because the majority of the interaction we get is drivel or abusive, and there's something very disheartening about, you know, slaving away on a piece, talking to a dozen people, travelling to two or three countries, writing the piece, and then you get, you know, 20 comments on it, of which 9 say, oh, well, why didn't you include this Manchester United player? And 9 sort of miss the point completely, and only 2 actually have anything to do with what you're talking about. When you do get those 2, then you know, it is great. And yeah, ultimately, once the initial emotional reaction against this, you know, against the abuse or against the nonsense, once you get over that, I think most journalists would agree that actually comments can be very beneficial. It's just the detritus you have to plow through to get there. In terms of alternate models for Blizzard, I guess, again, there's two ways of looking at it, or two different avenues there. One of them is the pricing, the pay what you want model, which I confess wasn't my idea. I wasn't particularly, I was quite skeptical about it. But essentially, we couldn't decide what the price should be. So we thought, for the pilot, we'll let people set the price. And it turned out the price they set did quite well. So we thought, I'll just leave it like that. And people have actually been very, you know, very fair, I think, in what they've paid. And I think that actually helps a sense of community, that writers don't know how much they're going to get paid when they write. You know, they get a share of the profit. And so you know, they're taking a risk. They're committing to the community. And equally, readers, you know, they pay what they want. They could pay a penny. So they're committing to the community by paying more than that. So it helps that collaborative feeling. We consider being digital only, but one of my
fuck, I can't get it off. I can't turn it off.
One of the things I was very keen on was to have a paper version, largely because over the last decade, there's been thousands of online football projects that have promised the world and delivered very little. And there's something I think still that gives you great credibility about a paper, you know, about a physical product. And also personally, I prefer to read in paper form. Now, that might make me old-fashioned, but it's a personal preference. And so we then decided, well, actually, there's no point doing a paper version that's sort of cheap. Because if people are interested in the words but not the feeling of a magazine, then they can read the various e-versions. So we decided actually the way we do it would be that the paper version would essentially be a luxury product that we'd have quite good quality paper, good quality printing, and if people wanted to pay for that, then it would be quite expensive. So I think it is relatively expensive given what it could be, but that seems to work because the audience seems to divide into two: the people who want to just read the words and are happy to do that on e-readers and Kindles and whatever. And then on the other side, the people who actually like the product, they like the smell of it, they like seeing it on their shelf.
All right, thank you.
Okay, on the editorial role, Liz Timms here in East Lansing has a question for you, Jonathan.
Yes, I had a question. I was looking through some of the back issues, and I noticed every once in a while you'll have a section focused on a particular event. Like in issue 4, I believe you were focused, there was a section on the African Nations Cup. And then in issue 11, there's one on the African Champions League. And I wonder when events like that come up, are you soliciting people to contribute pieces directly on that? Or is that just something that's kind of naturally coming in the submissions?
I think it normally starts out coming in the submissions. And then with the African Champions League, we got the pitch on the diary idea, and Ian Hawke had already suggested the stuff about DR Congo and Tibet Mazembe. And so I thought, well, those two work quite nice together. What else can I include in there? I knew James Montague was very well connected with the ultras at Al Ahly. That he was, I mean, just by chance, he was there right at the beginning of that story. So his contacts among the ultras there were, I think, better than pretty much any other journalist. So I thought, well, there's something there on the seventh Champions League they won, which, you know, it was of great emotional and political significance given the massacre at Port Said and everything. And then talking around with other African journalists I knew, asking for ideas, and we got the two Nigerian ideas as well. So it's sort of a mix. The initial pitch stimulates the idea, and then is there anything else we could do to make that a more complete section? And who can I commission to do that? I mean, things like the African Cup of Nations or the World Cup or the Euros, to be honest, that's largely just where I am. And often when you're at tournaments like that, you're so caught up in the day-to-day writing that you can lose the bigger picture. And it's quite nice after a tournament to be able to sit back and think, right, what was that all about? What was the... What can I write in 5,000 or 6,000 words that sort of sums up that tournament? It's partly where I've been, partly what people pitch, and then occasionally filling in the gaps to create a more complete section.
Great. Chris Lash, we've been having some sound problems with you. If you want to come back and ask your question, because you're next in line, I'm going to send you a message via the chat. See if you can pop back up. While we wait for Chris, then maybe Tom Vinacci, I think up in Portland, Oregon. Am I correct?
That's correct. I'm
okay.
In Portland.
Via Warsaw.
Warsaw is a song by Joy Division. That's all I know about Warsaw. My question, Jonathan, is, David Kais, you might want to take your earpieces out for this one. But is it possible, do you think, for a North American-based long-form essay Football Quarterly to survive as an independent the way the Blizzard is doing? By relying only on subscribers but not advertisers, XI Quarterly is really where I'm going with this. In North America, it was had a fantastic, from a readership point, in my opinion, a three-issue run, and it looks like it's just gone under or is just going under. My own theories are along the lines of, well, in the United States in particular, supporter culture is pretty young. It hasn't been passed from generation to generation. People that are following soccer in the United States are fairly young and are probably more into mobile technology than picking up a book and reading. So I wonder if it's possible for something like The Blizzard, which was XI Quarterly, 11 Quarterly, I'm sorry, to survive in the United States without relying on advertisers. Thank you.
I just don't know the North American market. I can't really say anything meaningful about that. What I can say about our audience is it's noticeably global. I think it's something like 1 in 6 of the visitors to our website. Now, that's not saying 1 in 6 of our subscribers. 1 in 6 of visitors to our website are from either the US or Canada. We've got an astonishingly large number of Norwegian readers. I'm not really sure why that should be, but I guess the fact that so many Norwegians speak such good English helps. But I think we've got pretty much as many Norwegian readers as we have Irish readers, which is something I can't quite understand, but it seems, well, it is true. So I guess, and I, you know, again, this is a guess. I don't know, but I would guess that there'd be a reluctance on the part of an English audience or a British audience to buy a North American magazine, which there wouldn't be on the part of a North American magazine to buy a North American audience to buy a British magazine about football. And I think Britain still has a credibility there, a global credibility that maybe the US is still lacking. Maybe things like Howler or 8x8, maybe they will change that. I mean, the first issue of 8x8 looked stunning to me, and obviously a lot of Blizzard writers have written for that as well. So the quality is certainly there. I you'd have to ask them about the audience. I don't know. I mean, I barely know our audience because it's not really my side of the business.
Fantastic. 8x8 was a fantastic issue, and I do enjoy Howler as well. But they do rely on advertising to exist and publish the glossy content that they're able to. So without that advertising, those two magazines, I don't think would exist. And I think you alluded to earlier, it would skew what you write about and what topics you can cover based on your advertisers.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends who the advertisers are. I mean, with Blizzard, we have advertising. We solicit advertising. If that starts to impinge on an editorial line, then we wouldn't do it. But so far, advertisers haven't. And we actually had nobody kind of called us out on it, but we had a slightly embarrassing thing. I think it was issue 2 or maybe 3, where we had an interview with Tostão in which he slagged off Pelé for being a corporate shill and said how terrible it was. Such a great player, it just become a sort of mouthpiece for companies. And on the very facing page where he said this was Pelé advertising a series of art prints, which was just the guys in the office just saw Pelé, stick it together. I didn't notice it in the proof, which I guess I should have done. But it actually was then sort of seen as being anarchically sort of undermining the advert, which really was complete accident. But I guess that's an instance where the people who gave us advertising for these Pelé art prints, they might have objected to that line, but nobody said anything.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
No
Okay, great. Christopher, if you're on...
So, hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
I'm actually an academic, but I'm also blogging about football. Just finding it quite interesting and difficult to break through. The question is basically, what do you think about the sort of new dominance of mainstream media via Twitter? Twitter creates new power structures. And is there any space for new writing from a different thing through?
Sorry, I lost you slightly at the end. Is there any space for new writing?
Coming through, you know, because
I think it's
great what you're doing, but in some respects you're also creating power structures yourselves, you know?
Yeah, you know, I accept that, and I think it's inevitable. I think there's two things there. Is this space for new writing? Absolutely. There's never been more football writers. I guess that makes it harder to stand out. But, you know, in the days 20, 30 years ago, football writers had to go through the slog of local papers onto national papers, and it was very hard to be seen. Now, if your stuff's good enough, interesting enough, different enough, you know, there's no reason not to be seen. And the great example of that is Michael Cox, who 3 or 4 years ago was a kid in his bedroom setting up his website, zonalmarking.net, and within a year he was writing for ESPN and writing for The Guardian, because he was doing these tactical analyses of games in a way that nobody else was doing, in a way that was very good, that the people enjoyed, and he basically did it very well, and there was a niche there. I don't know what kind of thing you're writing, but one of the problems that I see, for 2 years I taught on a sports journalism course, and pretty much everybody I taught on a course had their blog, and pretty much every blog was, here's my thoughts on Manchester United's game at the weekend. Well, you know, there's a million other sites, other blogs doing that. Why would anybody read that one? Even if it is brilliant, even if it is hilariously funny or incredibly insightful, how are you ever going to persuade enough people to start looking at that to gain a critical mass? So, I think the process is more democratic than it's ever been, but there's so many people trying to be football writers that then inevitably a lot of good people just never get seen. What Twitter's done, I think, it's begun to erode the power of the big media brands. I mean, it certainly hasn't done that entirely, and you know, there's still a cachet in writing for The Guardian or The Mail or whatever. But I think what you do see now is that people increasingly follow either the writer or a particular topic. And so they will follow a link to read a piece. You know, they don't care where it's hosted. So, you know, if I or another writer says, you know, wrote a piece a day on Stephen Keshe, and it happens to be on Betfair, well, people just click on the link because they want to read about Stephen Keshe, and it happens to be on Betfair. But the same piece could equally well be in The Guardian or Sports Illustrated or Fox or any other website. What I've found over the last year or two, which is, you know, a slightly odd feeling, is that new websites are setting up, and they're targeting journalists who have significant Twitter followings. So I mean, I've got 62,000. So they come to me and they say, "We'll give you X amount to write 600 words a week or whatever, but on the condition that you tweet a link to your article 2 or 3 times, whatever it happens to be," because actually what they're paying for is partly the writing, but also partly that access to 62,000 people who are interested in the sort of football writing that I do. And that is absolutely a power structure, you're right. I think Twitter has just begun that process of shifting the power away from the mainstream brands towards writers and also, I guess, topics in that. If you follow, you know, a Manchester United fanzine or something, they will tweet links to Manchester United articles, and again, you will click on that, and you might not initially know when you click on it. You know it's going to be about, I don't know, Tom Cleverley, is he good enough? You don't know that's going to be on Betfair, who scored, or The Sun, or whatever. You just click on the topic, and you don't really care where it's hosted.
Uh, I was just quickly to come in, I actually write about Polish football, so it sort of changes the dynamic a little bit there, because at least I've got a niche a little bit, whereas a lot of people don't have that. But then still, it's difficult because you can't, you know, you're not writing about Manchester United, and most people want to read about that. So that's all I'm saying. And someone else can ask a question now.
And of course, Jonathan has written a very fine book on football in Eastern Europe, so that's yet another topic for conversation perhaps in the future. But we have two questions lined up right now, one from Javier Pescador and one from Melissa Forbes. So Javier first.
Yes, congratulations on the on a similar topic. I wonder if you could give us your perspective on the intersections between football journalism and football scholarship, and how do you see an evolution of the two these two areas, and in which liminal state they can intersect and produce what we might call in the future, you know, footballology or the science of football or something like that?
I guess the intersection at the moment is largely, it's more through books and through newspapers and magazines. I mean, certainly my books, I've drawn on academic essays. It still seems, I mean, I speak slightly as an outsider here, you know, it still seems slightly to me that a lot of, I think, certainly early football academia was based on fans, on sociologies of fans. I get the impression, I'm an outsider, so I may well be wrong, that there's a growth into other areas. I mean, one of the things that writing the Pyramid, my book on tactics, that I found was it became actually a book as much about tactics as it became equally about how ideas are transferred and why they're transferred. Now, you know, I'm not for a second suggesting that my approach to that was an academic approach, but that clearly is something that would benefit from academic study. So, yeah, I think there's a big enough area there. But to be honest, I probably don't know enough about football academia to give a full or proper answer to that.
Anyone want to chime in here? This is a really important question. I was going to ask something like that too. Before we go to Melissa, because it's a key thread for all us footballologists. Anyone? Alon?
Yeah, I'll. Can I just chip in a little bit?
Of course.
It's just I think Jonathan's absolutely right. In Britain, at least, the emphasis was almost wholly sociological. And there was a sort of little cult of sociologist Leicester analysing hooligans for 20 years or so. In Germany, of course, there was lots of historical stuff because they were sort of obsessed and interested in the Nazi period. So there's a good deal of work from a completely different historical perspective. My sense is that, you know, we've barely begun. I mean, I think journalists who become, you know, writers of books have probably done a more varied range of things about football. But I don't know about academia, but you can come at football from so many different angles. And I haven't heard the word footballology before, but it's rather a good one. The idea that you can look at it from, there's all sorts of, almost every kind of humanities, also all sort of physiological, sports, sciences of various kinds, game theory, mathematics. It's a vast area, potentially. And because journalists aren't sort of hidebound by having to work within a particular discipline, I think maybe we, sort of without particularly meaning to, we are cross-disciplinary, just sort of whatever takes our fancy we'll write about, and perhaps academics can then explore stuff we've barely touched on and really do it in a much more deep, much better funded kind of way. So my sense is that, you know, this is just opening up. And this is, after all, the biggest cultural form on the planet now. The amount of attention that it receives is relatively tiny still. Yeah, that's it.
This is Alon. I think, can you hear me? Okay. I think Jonathan's writing, I've read three of his books and many of the articles in The Guardian, bridges the gap very nicely between deep analysis, historical analysis, and also the immediacy of journalism. Most journalism I find is in The Guardian, for example, is so obvious and so cliché-ridden. So if there's an article about why Manchester United lost two games in a row, it's like five talking points, and one of them is buy, buy, buy every player in the market. The other one is get Robin van Persie off the injured list. So that kind of writing to me is useless. I like how Jonathan has a wealth of cultural reference. Sometimes I find your writing a little bit stretching it a little bit too much, and that might relate to a question I have later about your latest book. But I think you do a fantastic job of really providing lively descriptions and great knowledge of tactics and history, and I learn a lot every time I read your articles, except that the last article on the refugee camp I thought was a little thin. And as you know, I don't think it is possible to write you know, an article after being there 2 or 3 hours, but I understand the constraints that you faced.
Thank you, Alon. Melissa, you have the next question.
Okay, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, thanks so much, Jonathan. I've actually been reading the Blizzard for a while now, and I really do appreciate the eclectic nature of it, I have to say. So my question is both personal, as a woman who plays, still plays, and watches, and does research in Latin America. So I'm this strange creature, a U.S. person, woman, who plays and is obsessed with the sport. But also from an academic and anthropological angle, so I taught a course on globalization through football. And, you know, we were thinking about how neo-globalization has affected the game. And, you know, one of those things is it's made it more diverse in a lot of ways in terms of, you know, labor questions, players circulating, ownership, TV rights, fans. Even the women's game, which we can see as still marginalized, I think there's more women playing, thinking about it. So I was wondering if, you know, that diversity, whether, you know, we can call it good or bad if we want to take up those kinds of questions, but have you also seen an increase in diversity in terms of the people who are actually writing about the game and getting their words out in print? So race, gender, nationality, are you seeing that same kind of diversity on that stage?
Yes, but it's very slow. I mean, if you go into, I mean, sorry, I'm speaking purely from, you know, going into British press boxes. But if you go into I was at Arsenal last night, I would guess 95% of the journalists there were white men. And that, I mean, it's something I've been quite conscious of in the contributions we've had to Blizzard, that it is very white male dominated, but I get way, way more submissions from white men. So I don't really know what I can do about that, but I think it is changing. I think there's the press boxes are becoming more diverse. I mean, when I started 10 years ago, that 95% figure would have been 99%. So things are changing, but it's very slow.
Do you think it has something to do with, I mean, do you see it reflected in journalism generally there, or do you think there's something about the sport, even though we know a lot of women watch, and, you know, obviously people of color, non-Europeans, non-sort of U.S. people watch and are engaged with it? Do you think it's just journalism generally still, or is it something about this sport?
I honestly don't know about journalism generally. And the only other thing I can compare it to is cricket journalism, and I'd suggest cricket journalism is even more white male dominated. Maybe it's a journalistic thing. I guess football in England is still, you know, for all that crowds have become more diverse in the last 20-25 years, still it's, you know, the majority of people going to stadiums at least are white males. So I guess to an extent it's natural. But it is changing. It's unquestionably changing. So I guess, you know, see where it is in sort of 10 years or so.
Great. As we wait for the next question, I think some of you already know this if you're following Twitter, but the official news from President Jacob Zuma in South Africa is that Nelson Mandela has joined the ancestors. He is now officially been pronounced dead. He is gone. So let's think of Madiba. He's done so much for South Africa and for the world, and he's changed a lot of our lives, and he's our thoughts are with him and his family at this moment. Okay, who would like to ask the next question or make a comment, please?
I have a quick question, a comment, and a question. This is Alon, by the way. As far as the comment, the first person who asked, I think Melinda, about football diplomacy, and there are quite a few interesting articles and research about the use of football in bringing together the two Yemens, Turkey and Armenia, and of course Israel-Palestine. So that might be something you might want to look at. And my question is actually about your latest book, Jonathan, which I reviewed for Soccer and Society and wrote a glowing review. So thank you for the check you sent me to write it. And I was wondering about women goalkeepers. You didn't include them in the book, and I was wondering about your thoughts about women goalkeepers, especially in light of personality traits, psychology, which you talk a lot about in your book. There's some interesting studies of women goalkeepers in Sweden and even Turkey, so I'm wondering if you have some thoughts about that in context of your fantastic book about goalkeepers.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you. The reason that I think in none of my books have I included women's football is I think you pretty much have to regard it as a different sport. There's this enormous pyramid, and you can go to watch, you know, the Albanian third division, and there's a chance you might see a player there who will emerge at a World Cup or will somehow work his way up to play in the Premier League. And you can only sort of take in so much. You can only know so much about so many things. And so because there is that automatic divide to women's football, it's just not something that I know anything about. I mean, I just don't know anything about the psychology of women goalkeepers. I don't think I've watch more than maybe a dozen women's games in my life.
Anyone else want to chime in? I have a question then, if there's silence in the group here.
I think Tom had a question, Peter. Tom Benassi.
Okay, just a sec. I'll get to you, Tom. What is your sense, Jonathan, about how the Blizzard has been received by the intellectuals, by the sociologists and the historians and the literature people and the anthropologists and so on? And at the same time, what's your sense of how it's been received by football journalists in the UK?
In terms of academics, it's very hard to say. The only guide I have is a number who seem to want to write for us, which is a very, very good thing. So certainly some academics like it. I can't say it was specifically aimed at an academic audience. In terms of journalists, there's certainly a proportion of them who think it's a bit pretentious, who feel a bit, I guess, challenged by it, a bit threatened by it. I don't think anybody's been sort of outright hostile to it, but I'm certainly aware that among some there's a sense of suspicion there. I think one of the problems you see, you see it with books or magazines that set out to sort of be an intellectual take on football, is that they tend to exclude mainstream, and not just football, actually sport in general. They tend to exclude the mainstream journalists who follow the league or follow the team on the circuit, as if because they have to file their 800 words every day, their previews and their match reports and their quotes pieces, as if they're somehow incapable of deeper thought or incapable of writing kind of better prose than that. One of the things I was quite keen to do from the start was not to exclude journalists, to sort of say to journalists, this is a chance to actually write something where you sit down, you've got 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, however long you want, 6 months, to write this. And you write it as well as you can. Don't worry about deadlines. Don't worry about length. Don't worry about, I've got to get this done, because if I don't get this done by 3, I'll never get this interview done. And when I've done that interview, I've got to go to this game. You know, I think a lot of criticism of day-to-day journalism neglects the conditions it's written under, neglects the speed at which you have to write, neglects the amount you have to write. I think journalists generally get quite angry about that. There's this sort of slagging off of the day-to-day pieces. But if you're writing something having been awake for 18 hours on a bus with, you know, drunken fans singing around you, and you're trying to file through a dongle, and the internet's coming in and out, and it's, you know, just to get any message through is an achievement, then actually I think the quality of a lot of what's written, particularly in the broadsheets in Britain, is very, very good. It won't stand up to look very good in 20 years' time if you don't consider that it was written in ridiculous circumstances. Sorry, I've gone off on a bit of a tangent there, but there's a conscious effort to include journalists, not to exclude them, to the people who you know, work the beat, and I think that generally has been quite respected. I mean, if submissions are the guide, then we get a lot of submissions from academics, we get a lot of submissions from journalists.
Thank you. Tom, sorry, I asked a question when you were already prepared to fire away, so now it's ball in your court.
Thank you, Peter. Jonathan, would the Blizzard be able to exist solely in a print format, a physical format, or is it being cross-platform, like readable on ebooks and smartphones, and marketed that way, being pushed via Twitter by somebody like yourself with a critical mass of followers. Is that electronic portion of it necessary for the Blizzard or any magazine like you to reach enough subscribers to stay in business?
Yeah, I think we're pretty reliant on Twitter, to be honest. If you look back at Perfect Pitch, which was a pretty similar format, which I think ran to 4 issues back in the late 90s, which was edited by Simon Cooper. And you read it now, it's absolutely outstanding, but it was very hard to market it. It was just in bookshops, and a lot of people just didn't know about it. Twitter immediately allows you to push it. You can push it every day if you want to. You can sell the T-shirts and merchandising around it, which just sort of doesn't make a huge amount of money, but just helps oil the wheels a bit. It just raises awareness. And I think the advertising potential of Twitter is extraordinary, in that those 62,000 people who follow me, probably half of them don't really exist. They're spam bots, or they've died, or they've got bored, or whatever. Maybe even more than half. But say the 20,000 who are left, they've chosen to follow me. They know what they're getting. They know that they're getting football looked at in a particular way. And so if you're then selling a magazine to them of football written in that particular way, but then that's an immediate audience. Whereas, you know, even if you put an advert in, you know, a newspaper that sells 500,000 copies a day, how many of those people are reading it for the football? Maybe half. How many people actually look at that page? How many people can then be bothered, having seen that, to go and type in the URL or you go to the bookshop and buy it? Whereas if you're just clicking through a link, it's there, it's immediate. So, you know, Twitter, I think, was absolutely essential. We couldn't have done it without Twitter. Having a critical mass of followers is clearly important to that. Could it survive without the digital versions? I suspect, well, it probably could just about survive, but it's definitely advantageous to have the two strands, because it means that we can reach people who don't want to pay the postage. And, you know, the postage from the UK to North America is horrendous, and there's nothing we can do about that. It's a post office who sets those fees. But it's a way of you know, transferring the information at no cost at all. And obviously, there's no printing cost or anything, so once we've set it on the page, any money that anybody gives us, and this is one of the reasons why I was persuaded by Peter, one of the two lads I run it with, to go with the pay-what-you-want model. Yeah, he made the point that if somebody pays 20 pence, it's 20 pence more than you would have got. And it's given it costs us nothing to produce that, then we might as well have that money. So it allows us to reach a much wider audience. It allows us to be available at very, very low cost, which allows us to reach people in less well-off countries and also less well-off people in Britain, North America, Norway, Ireland, wherever.
Yeah, fantastic. I can see your point where it would probably survive in the UK, but here in North America, in the United States, we just don't have the support for the sport the way you do in the UK. And I can't see a magazine like yours surviving over here. And I kind of wonder if that's where 11 Quarterly went wrong in North America. You know, fantastic topics, but not heavily marketed from what I could see anywhere else electronically. And, you know, I take a look at the Blizzard. I'll always come across in my timeline a link saying, hey, you know, read the Blizzard on your smartphone, or here's a link to an article, or specifically like you're mentioning, you know, pay what you like. And that's a great point that, you know, it's 20 pence or what have you, more than you had before. So I just wonder if that model would work here in the United States and in North America. Thank you.
Melissa, question, and then Dave Glovsky here.
Yeah, this goes back to the other conversation about who may be interested in writing for the Blizzard or other venues with more in-depth stories. And I was wondering, do you ever get players or ex-players, coaches maybe, who are actually taking interest in writing these kinds of things?
I don't think we've had anybody offer to write anything. I mean, what we did have, which is quite interesting, was Espen Bårdsen, who was former Tottenham and Norway goalkeeper who quit football age 25 and became an investment banker. He sort of made himself available to be interviewed because he'd somehow come across the magazine and was sort of intrigued by it and sort of thought his story was interesting, which it is. I mean, it's a very unusual thing for him to have done, and you know, the way he talked about his sort of boredom with football by the end, how he just hated the game and felt the need to get out. It's an angle you just don't hear. So, I mean, I know Roy Hodgson has read a couple of issues because I've given them to him. And he has mentioned them when I've met him again. So he has actually at least flicked through. Whether he's read them cover to cover, I don't know. I mean, Norway is a slightly odd place. I was at a seminar in Norway last week, I think. Last week. And it was astonishing how many coaches there had read it, both Inverting the Pyramid and Blizzard. So I spoke to Egil Olsen, who was our coach in the 90s and who's just been sacked again from a national team. And he'd read Inverting the Pyramid. Stalis Solbakken, who's at FC Copenhagen, who had a bad time at Wolves, he certainly read a couple of issues. So I don't know, for whatever reason, Norway seems to have this fascination with that type of football writing. And there's a very good Norwegian football magazine called Jossimar, which I think comes out every 2 months, but it's a similar idea to Blizzard. It's a bit thinner, but you know, comes out more frequently, and I write for that occasionally. And that really seems to have quite a significant hold on the Norwegian public. So for whatever reason, Norwegian fans seem to like this kind of thing. But no, to go back to the question, I don't think we've had a former player or a coach offer to write anything.
Thanks.
David.
Hi, Jonathan. My name is Dave Glovsky. I'm here at Michigan State. I was just wondering if in the future you'd consider kind of adding multimedia capabilities to the online version of the Blizzard, videos and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we have considered, and we sort of looked at a lot of multimedia options. One of the major problems is getting rights. The cost of rights to show goals or even clips of old games is prohibitive. Could we include interviews? I guess we could. But again, I mean, what would worry me is the cost, not necessarily of sending it out, but it's the cost of producing that. When we've done the Q&As, we do these question and answer sessions roughly 4 or 5 times a year, where we go to various locations and we have a presenter and we have 3 or 4 people on the panel, and we're like 2 halves of 45 minutes, which feels appropriate. We have questions from the audience and we have a discussion, and some of those we've videoed, some of those we've done podcasts of, just the audio version of it. And even that is actually surprisingly costly. So you know, we have toyed with that, but at the minute I think it would cost too much given, you know, what's still a relatively low income that we have.
Great, thanks.
Anybody out there? There are quite a few folks who haven't had a chance to ask a question. Andrew or Brian or Christoph. Juan Pablo, perhaps. Okay, Andrew Guest, why don't you go ahead and ask the next question then?
Okay, I'm curious the balance, and I think it's been implicit in some of the responses here, the balance between talking about football as a sport, as a game, as a competition, versus as a kind of cultural phenomenon, and it strikes me that a lot of the efforts to write about football outside of the mainstream media have to strike that balance in various ways and to varying degrees. And I also, I mean, even just reading some of the writing of people like yourself, Jonathan, and Simon Cooper, who has a contribution in this edition. I know Simon Cooper's been on record famously recently for saying he doesn't really like watching soccer anymore. Like he's sort of still interested in it as a cultural phenomenon, as a cultural form, or, you know, as a business phenomenon, but he doesn't really like the games anymore. And I almost get the sense from some of your writing, Jonathan, that you're a little bit the opposite. Like you and your introduction to the issue of the Blizzard that we read, you know, you sound sort of like, just leave me alone and let me watch the game and let me see the tactics of it. And My question is a little abstract, but I wonder if you could speak at all to striking that balance, both from a kind of philosophical perspective of what's meaningful to write, but also potentially from kind of a you know, an audience perspective. My sense is that if you know keeping the game in there, that's part of why, like, the Howler, in my mind, the Howler, in contrast with 11. The Howler is still about, it still's got glossy pictures of famous footballers. Whereas 11, I think, was really trying to be more the game as a cultural phenomenon. And whether that was the reason it didn't work as well, I don't know. So I know my question's a little abstract, but I'd be curious any thoughts that you have on that.
Well, I mean, I think you know, there's a place for both. And one of the things that irritates me a bit, and this is a particular problem with comment sections, is that people see a divide between enjoying the game and enjoying talking about the cultural phenomenon of football. Well, I'm not even sure there is a divide there. Never mind that it's an unbridgeable divide. And one of the books I did, the book I've just written that just came out a couple of weeks ago, so the goalkeeping book isn't actually my most recent book, a book called The Anatomy of Liverpool. And I did the same thing in a book in 2010, The Anatomy of England, where I took took 10 key games from England's history, 10 key games from Liverpool's history, and I analysed them in as much depth as is possible. You went into almost a pass by pass deconstruction of those games, and the impetus behind that with the England book was to try and forget the myth, forget the soap opera, forget the quotes driven nonsense which determines so much of sort of the modern discourse of football, certainly around the Premier League. That wanted to go back, wanted to go ad fontes, wanted to go back to the actual game themselves. And I mean, you find some things which are interesting merely in a quirky way. So, for instance, the game when West Germany beat England 3-1 at Wembley in 1972 in the quarterfinal of the European Championship, first leg, which is still spoken of today in England as being this great embarrassment for England, that West Germany turned up and they played this phenomenal football that England couldn't live with. And symbolically, that was sort of the death of Alf Ramsey's team, the team that won the World Cup in 1966. Although they'd lost in the quarterfinal to West Germany in 1970, it was they were pretty much on a par with them then. Goalkeeping error, a couple of bad substitutions cost in that game. 72, they're absolutely played off a park. And when you grow up and you see the highlights of the game and you hear people talking about it and you read reports, of course you just accept that. You go back and you watch the video, and what you see is actually quite an odd game, in that for half an hour West Germany are absolutely unbelievably good, and Franz Beckenbauer said he never played half an hour football like it. That every single pass went exactly where it had to go, everybody moved where they should move. And England are very, very lucky to only be 1-0 down after that half hour. England then come back into it. They play very well for 45, 50 minutes. They don't dominate in the way Germany dominated the first half hour, but when they equalise after 77 minutes, you can't say it's undeserved. And then they chase the game and let two in the last quarter of an hour on the break, and end up being beaten 3-1, which actually somehow becomes a fair reflection of the game, but doesn't actually tell the narrative of the game. So it doesn't have any meaning beyond... We tend to simplify things when we write about them, and possibly not. But it intrigued me. And what I then found is that the more in-depth you go, the more in detail into the game you go, the more springing off points you find as to wider cultural phenomena. So you suddenly realise that the reason that pressing football, that teams are able... To close down a man with the ball in a sort of coherent, organised way, that three people will go to the man with the ball and then everyone then block off a space to stop him having a simple pass. The reason you're able to do that from sort of the late 60s onwards is just better nutrition. In the days of rationing, which only ended in 53 in England, you could never have done that. And then there's a period where fitness is improving, and after 10 years, people start to press. And once you slow the game down, once you analyse it pass by pass, you start to see that actually in the late 50s, people were starting to do that, but they were getting 5 yards from a man rather than 3 yards from a man. So that very in-depth, and that's talking specifically about football on the field, but I'm also in-depth about sort of the build-up to the game, the immediate aftermath of the game. And so by sort of reading every newspaper report in the week leading up to the match and the week after the game, you immediately place it in a context of what else was going on historically at the time. I'm certainly not saying it's the only way to do football history, but it seemed to me quite a useful new way of doing it, that in-depth focus, particularly with the Liverpool book, actually, you start to see that within Shankly's Liverpool, for instance, this narrative of Shankly arriving and building the club up and everything being brilliant, obviously it wasn't as simple as that. You start to see the fractures, the stress points. You start to see where Shankly was actually very bad at dropping people. He hated confrontation. So even though he had this very bluff exterior, he hated telling players he liked that they were dropped. And so by this in-depth analysis of what actually happened in the build-up to a game, and there's a game at, I think it was at Newcastle, when Ian St. John, the centre-forward, who'd won the FA Cup with him in 1965, when he finds out that he's not in the team. And Shankly can't bear to tell him, so he waits till he's out of the dressing room, tells everybody else the team, and then disappears. And St. John only finds out because somebody else tells him. So little details like that, which you only find by going really into the minutiae of it, sort of tell you a much bigger truth. So there's something interesting there, I think, where in intense, you're sort of zooming in on the game, somehow illuminates much wider topics.
Great, thank you. There's a question from David Kilpatrick, the historian of the New York Cosmos.
I just want to say, first of all, it's a real honor to speak with you, Jonathan. The Inverting Pyramid is one of my absolute favorites, and it's going to be a Christmas gift for a lot of people from me yet again.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for acknowledging the greatness of Nicholas Bentner. I really appreciate it. And I wanted to, since I'm a gooner, just kind of bring attention to the Charlie Robinson piece in issue 9. One of my favorite pieces from all 12 issues. In the issue of the partisan versus the purist, you've never really hidden the fact that you're a Sunderland supporter. I really don't know why you haven't hidden the fact you're a Sunderland supporter. but in terms of football writing, it seems to me that, well, at least for me personally, in the fall of 94 when I read Fever Pitch by Hornby, it kind of changed my life in terms of the possibilities for football writing. And it seems to me that from issue 0 on, the Blizzard has kind of picked up on that, and the diversity of the writing really in many ways is indebted to what Hornby accomplished from Fever Pitch. I wondered if it was a similar watershed moment for you, the publication of Fever Pitch, and if there's more and more now voice for the partisan beyond just blogs and the like.
I think there's a sort of a general movement. You know, we mentioned it right at the start that the fanzine movement, which really sort of began as a reaction to the horrors of English football in the late 80s with, you know, Heysel and Bradford and Hillsborough, as a sort of almost if fans needed to find a way of expressing themselves, needed a way to find, you know, to tell the world that there was more than tragedy to football. I was very young, so I had very little perspective on this, but I was involved in that from a very early stage. That I wrote for Love Supreme, a Sunderland fanzine, from, I think, 1990, maybe 91. So I was only 14, 15 at the time. And so my first experience of writing football, my first experience of writing football was writing match reports on games my teddy bears had played, age about 6 or something. But my first sort of experience of writing football to be read to a proper audience to be published was from the fanzine movement. So it was necessarily partisan from the beginning. It never occurred to me that I should hide the fact I'm a Sunderland fan. I think anybody who talks to me for more than half an hour will quickly. There's a great story that Harry Pearson, who used to have a column in The Guardian, he's a Middlesbrough fan, but great story he tells of he used to go to a barber in the village he lived in Northumberland, and the barber was absolutely obsessed by Len Shackleton, who was a winger who played for Newcastle and then moved to Sunderland. And in the far corner, he basically relates a series of conversations with his barber where it doesn't matter what his opening gambit is, whatever Harry Pearson says first, within 2 minutes they'll be talking about Len Shackleton, because everything in the barber's mind is focused on Shackleton, that the whole world is just somehow a great explanation of the genius of Shackleton. And I fear that I'm not dissimilar with Sunderland. If you talk to me, I'll end up talking about Sunderland. But you've done very well to get through what, 79 minutes without me talking about Sunderland. And so it never occurred to me I should hide it. My accent is less pronounced than it used to be, but yeah, certainly when I first started in journalism, I had quite a strong Sunderland accent. I still find it very hard to not to say we when I talk about them. But I kind of think it's just more honest that the vast majority of journalists, not all journalists, support a team. The reason that they write about football is they started going to games very young, and they attach themselves to either a local team or a team they were connected to through their family, or as a team that they liked from an early age. And so while when I write about Sunderland, I will try to be objective, I think it's more honest to acknowledge the fact that at times possibly I'm not objective, and to let people know that. Now, if I supported what's the best way of putting this, a more recently successful team, if I supported an Arsenal or a Tottenham or Manchester United, where more people have an opinion about them, maybe that would make things harder. People would get irritated at me for pursuing a particular line, which happened. I mean, John Cross from the Mirror, who is, I think, an excellent tabloid journalist, and he's very clearly an Arsenal fan and doesn't hide it. And he gets a load of grief from people who think that everything he writes is to beat the Arsenal drum, to kind of somehow benefit Arsenal. Yeah, he writes stories as a journalist. A lot of them happen to be connected to Arsenal because that's where he knows people. Maybe that would be different. But nobody really hates Son. Even Newcastle fans don't really hate Son. They just sort of pity us. Maybe if it was a bigger club or a recently bigger club, it would be different. But I think. Yeah, the honest thing to do is to acknowledge that I am a Sunderland fan, and things I write may be coloured by that. In terms of whether reading Fever Pitch was a watershed moment, I think yeah, it was up to a point. I think really there were three books in the space of 3 or 4 years which really paved the way for what's happening in football literature now. And they were all played out: the Pete Davis book about the 1990 World Cup, Football Against the Enemy, Simon Cooper's book, and Fever Pitch. And in some ways, Fever Pitch is probably the one of them that stands up best now. That you're 20 years on, you read it, and you sort of think, actually, there's subtleties there I didn't really pick up on at the time. That it actually remains an excellent book, which isn't to say the other two don't. It's just Fever Pitch, whenever I pick it up, it strikes me that there's things there that I've forgotten or things I've missed. And it's one of those books, if you take off a shelf, you do find yourself kind of reading it 15 minutes later rather than just having read the thing you mean to refer to. So yes, I've always been part of Zan, and yes, Fever Pitch was revelatory.
The fourth official is raising the sign, and so it means we're coming to a close in today's forum. Anyone want to ask the final question or make a final comment?
I just want to say thank you for what you're doing for football literature. You really are a pioneering spirit, and I'm so very grateful for what you do.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you very much.
Melissa, you have the last word today. Go for it.
Oh, no, this may not be a good place to end, but I'm just really curious about sort of, and maybe it's the anthropologist in me, but football journalist in terms of, is there a lot of solidarity between you because of the things that you have to deal with in terms of, you know, managers and FIFA and trying to get a story and all that kind of stuff? Is that something that develops even if you write for different outlets or have different, maybe like political views or something?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a slightly odd business, particularly if you're part of the pack. I'm talking purely about England here. Other countries may be very different, I don't know. But the pack sort of follows... the way it works, every paper has a number one, the sort of the chief writer who will do the big stories, who will cover England. And then you have beat reporters who will normally have two in London, one in Liverpool, one in Manchester, one in the North East, one in the Midlands, who would cover the local sides there. And so you travel around in the same group if you're part of the pack. The London writers travel together because they're watching the big London games. The number ones travel together because they're watching the big games. People drift in and out. If there might be two big games at weekends, it would split. But you see an awful lot of each other, and particularly at World Cups and European Championships and things, you spend an awful lot of time in the same hotel, hanging around the same press conference rooms, hanging around the same stadiums, and it's a strange relationship in that, in theory, you're competing with each other to get stories and to get the best access and to write the best intros and whatever, and yet at the same time, the people you're competing with become your mates because you spend all your time with them. And you often see people sort of conspiring not to release stories, not to tell their desk that the story's happened because they want to save it for a day later or because they actually just want to suppress the story for whatever reason. And so there's a strange negotiation goes on between the needs of the individual, the needs of the pack, and the needs of the newspaper. Now, I sort of existed on the fringes of that when I was the FT's football correspondent between 2003 and 2006, because the FT didn't take football as seriously as most papers, so there was never the same pressure on me. So I was never anybody's rival, which sort of made it slightly easier for me, but at the same time I was always slightly on the outside. And there is something, I think, quite intimidating about the pack. And newcomers or people who aren't of the pack often are sort of quite put off by it and see it as being quite a hostile thing. But it's sort of natural that they close ranks against outsiders, because if you're there getting an interview and you want to save those quotes for 2 days later because you know you've got to travel in the 24 hours later, so you can't get an interview that day, the last thing you want is some interloper coming in, nicking a quote, putting a story out and killing your story, and meaning that you've got to find something else for 2 days' time. So there's a very intense camaraderie there, and often working in difficult conditions or having to deal with managers being difficult, the time pressure, and at the same time it can become quite bitchy and quite unpleasant, because you are competing with each other. And if you have the best will in the world, if you spend 5 weeks living in the same hotel, getting on the same bus, going to the same stadiums as the same people, you are going to have points of friction. At the moment, because of the nature of what I do, that I sort of float around freelancing for everybody, doing my own thing, I sort of exist happily on, with one foot in the pack and one foot outside. So if I need to be on the inside, they tend to let me in. But I can spend a lot of the time looking at them, watching them, thinking what a bizarre business this is, and actually being quite glad that the pressure they're under to get stories, not to miss anything. That's the worst thing. If everybody else has a story and you somehow haven't got it, and it's been kept from you for some reason, which I've seen happen to people, which is a horrible thing when the sort of pack rejects somebody. Somebody should study the pack anthropologically. I think it is a fascinating phenomenon. But I've been doing the job long enough now. I know a lot of people in the pack, and people who would have been quite hostile to me when I first started because they didn't know who I was, now accept me, and it's there is definitely camaraderie there. And I think actually the great example of that was the story that happened earlier this year when Ollie Kay, who writes for The Times, who is actually one of the saner members of the pack, he was misled by a source into believing that Qatar were going to set up a summer tournament for clubs, which had huge ramifications in that it could destabilise the World Cup. It could be something that Qatar could fight off a threat to take the World Cup off them in 2022. Their retaliatory gesture could be to undermine the Champions League by setting up a club competition. So it was a huge story, and we've all heard whispers of something like this going on, and Ollie seemed to have concrete evidence. It turned out it was a con man who, for whatever reason, had misled him and had misled a couple of clubs. And so when Ollie did a ring round of clubs, the clubs, some of them either thought it was true or they were terrified of being seen not to be part of this. So they sort of undernard and went, we know about this, because everybody had heard some kind of rumour. And it then turns out that it is a scam, and actually the evidence that Ollie thought was concrete turned out to have been a spoof on a French website. So it was pretty embarrassing for him. And people from outside the pack savaged him, and a Canadian blogger in particular went mad at him. And the pack could have turned on him. They could have got rid of the Times as number one, somebody who's very, very good. And they didn't. They supported him because they know he's essentially a good bloke and a good journalist. And that could have happened to anybody. He hadn't really done that much wrong. He just got conned by a con man. So there is quite a strong camaraderie.
Peter, can I add one short comment here? Is there time?
There is 1 minute of added time.
Okay. I just wanted to say that the pack turned on me when I went to a press conference of Bayern Munich in Israel when they played in the Champions League, and most of the questions of the journalists were about the latest injury, fights among players or with the coach, and I asked this philosophical question about his tactics, Van Gaal's coaching tactics and background, and afterwards journalists seemed to be angry at me, but Van Gaal came to me after the press conference. And we talked for about 20 minutes. I think he was happy to be asked a big philosophical question. So that was my experience with being turned on by, set by the pack.
I mean, I don't know about German journalism particularly, but I've seen that kind of thing happen in England. And the reason it happens is very simple, is that the needs of the pack are you get short, sharp questions, short, sharp answers to get your back page the next day. Their needs are different to your needs. You were interested in this philosophical question. As far as they were concerned, you were wasting their time. Mm-hmm. So obviously a press conference, if you have accreditation for it, you have every right to ask a question. But, you know, it goes against their wishes, and so they react against it.
I'm afraid the referee's whistle has blown. I'm not sure what the final score of this match might be. We don't generally keep score in this pelada of football conversations. But I want to thank Jonathan Wilson for kindly and generously sharing your time with us and your insights, and for producing this wonderful piece of football literature that we all look forward to every couple of months. And the audio recording to this session will be made available soon. And look also for an email detailing the wrap-up and Twitter timeline for this conversation. And I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks again to everyone, especially to Jonathan, and we'll be in touch soon.
Cheers, thank you.